This is a favorite story, at least of cars, but probably of many of us. A fantastic story, and I want to say a few words about faith and the way we think about it today, and talk about what it means to grow as well. But I want to start by talking about Tinkerbell, obviously, right? For those of you who, I'm not sure how familiar the story of Peter Pan is around the world, but in the West, most of us have some, at least heard of the story of Peter Pan. It was written by a man named J.M. Barrie over 100 years ago, the turn of the last century. And it's a story of Peter Pan, a young boy who was refusing to grow up. And he lived in a faraway land and traveled to visit three young children, and then took them with him into this magical land, a land where there were fairies, including Tinkerbell. Now, this story was written both as a book and as a play, and Barrie was there when it was being put on for the first time, and what he had done is he had created a moment in the play where Tinkerbell gives up her life to save Peter. And then Peter comes out to the people in the audience with Tinkerbell, who has died. And he breaks, as we say, breaks the fourth wall, and he speaks right to the audience. Now, we are no longer living in a time where we believe in fairies. He said, but if you clap right now and show that you believe in fairies, Tinkerbell will come back to life. Would you please clap? Would you please bring her back to life? And Barrie was very nervous that the crowd, the audience, wouldn't clap. And so he'd instructed the orchestra that was there to start clapping right away, just in case, you know, because the story depended on Tinkerbell coming back to life. That would have been a real downer to the whole play. But right away the audience clapped and clapped. And that became the practice, or the habit. That was how it happened every single time the play was performed. In the modern West, we live in a place where it's difficult for us to believe in witches. It's difficult for us to believe in magic, in fairies, in monsters and magical creatures. But we're aware that at some point in the past, people did. And maybe we're aware that in many places today, there's not a question about those things either. They know that there is magic because they have experienced it against them. They have been hurt by it. And so for them, this whole thought of clapping to make something real and believing in something, it makes no sense. It's nonsense. Of course, I know it's real because I've been affected by it. I know fairies are real. They're not kind. They're dangerous. I know the sea is a dangerous place and that there's monsters in it because I've suffered there. Now, for us, though, we've come to think about faith as almost like something you will up inside yourself, and that it belongs to believing in things that aren't otherwise possible. In movies over the last 40 years, at least in my life, we have movies like The Neverending Story, and a young boy named Sebastian has to believe in this other world in order for it to be saved. It's crumbling and dying because he has stopped believing, and his faith will restore it. In the Christmas movie, Elf, Santa Claus, his sleigh flies because some people believe in Santa Claus. And there's a dramatic moment when it's not working, and then people begin to sing Santa Claus is Coming to Town, and it shows people all over the place singing, and there's this swelling of faith and belief, and suddenly his sleigh soars off into the sky. When Jesus said, "You of little faith, why did you doubt?" Do we, and at least those of us who've been raised in the modern West, do we tend to think of faith as something that has to be willed within us? Something that rises and lowers, and that if we have enough of it, accomplishes things. For those of you who play video games, there's a few here. Your character will sometimes have these little bars in the top corner showing you, for every dot, how healthy you are, your strength, your stamina, but also maybe your, we could say, faith. You'd have a faith meter, and it's going up and down. And if you have that, you can accomplish magical things. We sometimes think prayer, or at least I hear us speak as if we only believed more, prayer would be effective. I'm saying it, but if I could just really mean it. In the New Testament, I would suggest that this is not to be found anywhere. That is not how they thought, and it is not how Jesus is talking. When Jesus talks about the faith, it's always faith that has been demonstrated in action. We might choose faithfulness or trust as better words. So when the woman was sick, the faith that she had was the fact that she, against, with all of the courage she could muster, she went into the crowd and she touched Jesus. That was her faith, the action she took, the risk she took. When the centurion came to Jesus, he was taking a great risk, approaching a Jew and asking the Jew to heal someone in his own household. When in Mark it says few people were healed and Jesus says there's no faith, it's because nobody was coming out and taking the risk of asking Jesus to heal. Faith is something that is acted out, it is lived out, it is better translated trust. Or faithfulness. And here in this passage, we see Peter, we read, Peter doubted. But maybe you've noticed in other translations, maybe you have them here, not the word doubted, which for us sounds like some sort of internal wrestling and grappling, but the word is wavered. He hesitated. Life requires courage. But growing courage is like growing a muscle. You can't just decide to grow muscles and it will happen. I decided to get in shape. I bought a pair of runners and the last 10 years they've done nothing to help me. You know, I thought that would be do it. You can't just will muscles to grow. They grow by use. And courage only grows by use. Courage grows from action. As Christians, our courage grows when we obey Jesus and when we trust Jesus because we know him. And it leads us to take risks and to try things, whether it's in prayer or in service or in action of some kind. The story today of the disciples caught in a storm is the second time in Matthew the disciples were caught on the sea in a storm. You remember the first time Jesus was asleep. He was sleeping in the boat and a storm came in Matthew and began swamping the boat. And the disciples were terrified and they cried out, "Lord, save us." And Jesus said to them, "You of little faith, why are you afraid?" And he woke up and he rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a dead calm. And they were amazed, and they asked a question. What sort of man is this? Even the winds and the sea obey him. And now a few chapters later, the disciples are in a boat again. A storm has blown in again, and they can't make it to shore. Jesus walked out to the water, on the water to them. And they were terrified. And this time it is Peter who cries out, "Lord, save me." And Jesus said, "You of little faith, why did you waver?" And when Jesus got into the boat, the wind ceased. And this time those in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly you are the Son of God." The first story leaves us with the question, who is this? And a few chapters later, it is answered, "You are the Son of God." The disciples in the first story are awed and stunned and confused and bewildered. The second time, they've come to know Jesus a bit more. And this time they worship. They were growing and knowing Jesus. And the sign of their growth was worship. To grow in knowing Jesus, we must do it the way the disciples did. The only way one person can get to know another person, by spending time with them, by listening to them, by taking risks with them, and in Jesus' case, by trusting him and by obeying him. We come to know Jesus in this way, and we know that we are coming to know Jesus more when in our relating with him, we worship him. And that word, by worship, we mean when we love Jesus more, when we respect Jesus more, when we know that we are honoring him more in our lives, when it is natural for us to praise him and thank him, and when we trust him. This is what it means to worship Jesus. And we know we are knowing him when we begin to do these things in our lives. The Psalms and the prophets tell us that God alone defeats the waves and the water. They point to the Exodus story, when God commanded the sea to part and his people passed through safely on dry ground. And then God caused the waters to attack Pharaoh's army that was chasing his people, and they were defeated. The fact is that many of the ancient Near East peoples of that time had stories about their own God who controlled the waters. The waters were often a monster that threatened life, a dragon. We see that in the carvings of their gods and in the stories that we have preserved from different cultures. In Babylon, the god Baal fought and killed the monster Tiamat, the water dragon. And then Baal used her body, split it in two, and put one side up in the air and one beneath, a section above and a section beneath, so that living things could live in between, in the in-between space. At the same time, a prophet wrote Genesis 1 that revealed the truth about God. Not a God who had to create through murder and destruction and violence, but God who with a word stilled the deep waters, and by a word caused the waters to separate above and below, so that birds and fish and land and all land creatures could thrive within that space. To go back to our story, the first time the disciples were caught at sea, with a word, Jesus commanded the wind and the waves to be still. And this time, Jesus put the waters under his feet as he walked on them. For the disciples, they were learning the only way a human being can learn, through their own experience, through scary things, terrifying moments, through challenges and hardship. Every human being, this is how we learn. And they were learning as we do, through failure. Peter failed in this moment. The disciples failed. They had been shown that Jesus had all authority, and they were still afraid. They failed, and they learned. We can learn from them, for we fail. We don't remember. We're afraid. But what we learn here in the story is not only that Jesus has authority over the wind and the waves, but that Jesus is merciful and loving. And he saves Peter right away and saves the disciples right away. They were learning the only way human beings can. They were learning to trust God and to trust Jesus. But Jesus didn't spare them the storm either time. If Jesus really loved them, maybe like me, you're thinking, why would he not just save them from going through that grief? Why allow them to experience terror? Why allow them to experience this sense that they're about to die? And I don't know the answer. Jesus did not even prevent his own suffering and death. Neither Jesus nor God nor anyone else in the Bible says there's nothing to be afraid of. That is not what is said ever. Instead, in Isaiah, suffering's not a question of if, it's a question of when. As you heard Carr read for us this morning, when you walk through fire, when you pass through the waters, it will come into your life. But God will be with you. And as we go through these things, our courage comes from growing in trust that Jesus is with us, that Jesus does hear us when we cry out to him. Jesus said, in our translation, what is it? I can't remember. Be of good courage is the translation I like. Have courage. I am with you. I am. Don't be afraid. It's not that there's not things to be afraid of, but have courage because I will be with you. Jesus had commanded the wind and the waves with the word, and now he commanded Peter. And he said to Peter, come. And Peter did. He stepped out onto the water. But the wind and the waves distracted him. He took his eyes off of Jesus. Peter's trust in Jesus in that moment wavered, and he hesitated in obedience. It is unhelpful for us to think at this moment that there was something within him that he needed to well up, that he needed to do something, like have more faith, and if he just tried harder, his feet might have rose up. What he needed to do was to keep obeying Jesus. Not to take his eyes off Jesus, but to keep taking steps in obedience. And whatever he was feeling was what he was feeling. The courage should have been there to help him keep putting one foot in front of another. Jesus had said, come, but Peter stopped. Anxiety and distraction, he froze, and he stopped obeying Jesus. Peter turned his attention to the problems all around him instead of keeping his focus on the person who was in front of him. We have other examples like this from Scripture. In the book of Genesis, we have the story of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And Lot and his wife and his two daughters were saved out of that city, but they were told, flee and do not look back. Don't stop. Don't look back. Keep looking ahead. But Lot's wife wavered. She hesitated. Instead of obeying, instead of focusing on what was ahead, she was distracted and looked back. And she died. This word that in our translation, where it says Peter doubted, that I've suggested is, or I pointed out is used elsewhere, is translated elsewhere as waver. This word only appears one other time in the entire New Testament. It's also in Matthew. It's the story of the resurrection. Interesting, you know, if you like literary things, we're in the center of the book of Matthew, and this word is used. Now if you go to the very end of Matthew, it's used again. Maybe Matthew didn't notice. In the resurrection, the disciples meet Jesus. He's on a hill. And it says, when they saw Jesus, they worshipped him, but some doubted, or some wavered, some hesitated. And we have speculated before what was holding them back. Am I really forgiven? I've betrayed this man. I abandoned him. I let him suffer. I denied him. Am I really forgiven? Can I really come forward like he's telling me to? Am I able to trust him? Am I really going to bow before him? This man has all authority over heaven and earth. Am I going to give him my life as well? Will I obey him in everything? Some wavered and hesitated, but some had courage. I know I've sinned, but I am going to step forward. I don't know what this is going to cost me, but I am going to come forward. I don't know what he might ask of me, but I am going to obey him. I'm going to come forward. They grew in that moment in courage. They grew in knowing Jesus, and they grew in trust. When Peter cried out, "Lord, save me," he was still terrified. He was still the person who Jesus would say had little faith. But when he cried out to Jesus, Jesus didn't wait for the faith to rise up, the faith to change. Jesus immediately reached out and took hold of Peter and saved him. We do not need to wait to get our lives in order before we cry out in desperation to Jesus. We don't have to wait until we have a certain level of faith before we cry out to Jesus, "Lord, save me." Because Jesus will come. Nothing should ever stop us. Nothing we have done, nothing we are feeling, nothing we are going through should ever stop us from crying out to Jesus, "Save me." Whatever you are facing, whatever you are dealing with, whatever failures you have been through, whatever is making you afraid, Jesus says, "I will be with you to the end." And we just need the courage to continue to come near to him, to continue to get to know him, the courage to trust him, knowing that we can always cry out to him. And our trust and our courage will grow the more we know him and the more we take those steps of obedience.